worse, they take up very precious time that ought to be given to what is spiritually beneficial. The truth is rather in what God reveals than in what groping men surmise. Augustine was not a full opponent of reason. If not for original sin, Augustine said, reason alone could have connected man with God. But grace had to fill the gap between man and God after the fall. Reason couldn't be the primary fuel for crossing that boundary. Christianity solved the dilemma of the polis versus the individual by suggesting that Jesus' transformation of the world was essentially spiritual, not material. Judaism had posited that the Messiah would be a political figure, not primarily a spiritual one. And that very idea put Judaism inherently in conflict with any powerful material empire. Christianity redefined the concept of the Messiah entirely. Paul morphed the Jewish belief in a political Messiah who would usher in an age of worldly peace to the Christian belief in a spiritual Messiah who had to die to atone for human sins. This division was made clearest by Augustine, who in the aftermath of the fall of the Roman Empire was deeply concerned with rejecting the idea that Christianity's rise had led to the collapse of the empire. Augustine dealt in dichotomies, chief among them the division between what he called the city of God and the city of man. The city of God revolves around virtue. It is the community of Christians who have been initiated by grace into Jesus' love. The city of man is the material city, the polis so treasured by the Greeks, grasping, materialistic, incapable of bringing happiness, in Augustine's description. This dichotomy suggested that the existing governments need not feel threatened by Christianity, which, after all, just sought the hearts of men in worship. Christianity was beyond politics. Citizenship was to be governed by the city of man. Augustine wrote, Christ's servants, whether kings or princes or judges, whether soldiers or provincials, rich or poor, free or slave, men and women alike, are told to endure, if need be, the worst and most depraved republic and, by their endurance, to win for themselves a place of glory in the most holy and majestic senate of the angels, so to speak, in the heavenly republic whose law is the will of God. The realm of man was man's. The realm of God was God's. In reality, of course, the church would quickly centralize temporal as well as spiritual power. Augustine's dichotomy between the city of God and the city of man actually supported that power seizure, since the best city of man would presumably be the one that utilized the values of the city of God. Augustine controversially followed the path of power on occasion, too. When a schismatic sect called the Donatists threatened him and the regime under which he lived, Augustine used the Roman authorities to quash them, arguing, "You are of opinion that no one should be compelled to follow righteousness, and yet you read that the householder said to his servants, whomsoever ye shall find, compel them to come in. Sometimes the shepherd brings wandering sheep back to the flock with his rod." Defenders of Augustine said this was less doctrinal than an emergency defense. Either way, the Catholic Church would not shy away from the arrogation of power over the course of coming centuries. The victory of Christianity. The spread of Christianity was immediate and far-reaching. Historian Rodney Stark estimates that there were about 1,000 Christians in the year 40 CE. By the year 300, there were some 6 million Christians, a growth rate of some 40% per decade. What drove Christianity's spread? There have been several theories, aside from the obvious spiritual ones. First, concurrent historians suggested that Christianity's rise had been driven by admiration for its system of care for the poor. The Emperor Julian, a committed opponent of the church, spoke of pagan shortcomings when compared with the moral character, even if pretended, of the Christians, including their benevolence towards strangers and care of the graves of the dead. Julian saw Christians' attention to the impoverished as a chief outreach method. Then there was the fact that Christianity was the only religion actively seeking converts. After the destruction of the Jewish temple in 70 CE, Judaism had stopped religious outreach. There is controversy as to whether Judaism sought religious conversion even before that event. Because Christianity proposed both universal salvation and exclusive salvation, furthermore, it drew adherents from Roman society. It's easier to evangelize those of foreign religion if they are barred from eternity by failure to join. Early Christians were persecuted brutally by the Romans, who saw them as a rebellious and millennialist offshoot of the Jewish tree. But Christianity's division between the spiritual and material worlds allowed various emperors to treat the religion as either a scapegoat or as a potential source of support. Emperor Diocletian launched the most vicious round of persecution against the Christians in 303 CE. But in 311 CE, Emperor Galerius issued an edict of toleration, granting Christianity the status of legal religion within the Eastern Empire. 2 years later, the Edict of Milan extended that toleration to the Roman Empire as well. Finally, in 325, Emperor Constantine took part in the First Council of Nicaea, an ecumenical council designed to settle the main points of Christian canon. The result of that meeting, the Nicene Creed, set the theological framework for Christianity. On his deathbed, Constantine finally converted to the religion he loved. In 380, Emperor Theodosius made Christianity the official state religion of the Roman Empire. The astonishing rise of a tiny Jewish sect to the religious leadership of the most powerful empire on earth was complete. But the Roman Empire was already tottering on its last legs. In 476, the last emperor of Rome, Romulus Augustus, abdicated at point of sword. The Eastern Empire, based in Constantinople, remained, transforming into the Byzantine Empire and lasting all the way until the 16th century. The collapse of the Roman Empire in the West fragmented the continent in terms of political control. The Catholic Church moved quickly to fill the gap, centralizing both temporal and spiritual power. From the fall of Rome through the 12th century, Christianity would spread from its base in the Italian peninsula to the British Isles, France, Germany, and eventually the Nordic countries as well. While Augustine had posited a great divide between the city of God and the city of man, the Catholic Church was quite active in the city of man. The church received tithes from Christians the continent over and had its own ecclesiastical courts. By the 10th century, the church was the single largest landowner in Western Europe. Kings found their legitimacy through the conduit of the church and battled with the church to expand their own power. Holy Roman Emperor Henry IV walked barefoot in the snow to earn back the approval of Pope Gregory VII. Henry II of England, 1133 to 1189, had himself flogged in order to win back the approval of his Christian population after accidentally ordering the death of Archbishop Thomas Becket. Popular history maintains that this period represented the Dark Ages. But that's simply inaccurate. Progress continued as Christianity spread. The monastic system centralized learning in monasteries, where priests and nuns devoted themselves to ascetic pursuit of divine understanding. In educational terms, this devotion revolved around scripture. The Benedictine monks, for example, lived under the rules created by Saint Benedict, 480 to 547, a set of orders regarding the hierarchy of monasteries, the behavior by which to abide, and the requirements of work. The arts thrived in the monastic system. Manuscripts were preserved by monks devoted to writing new copies and beautifying them. In the monastic system, the liberal arts taught by the Greeks and the Romans, as championed by Cicero and Seneca, among others, survived, albeit in spiritualized form. Augustine himself, despite his distaste for paganism, suggested that the liberal arts education could be hijacked for service to God. Augustine likened such cultural appropriation to the Jews taking Egyptian gold during the biblical Exodus. This is their gold and silver, which they have not created themselves, but have extracted from certain ores, as it were, of precious metal, wherever they found them scattered by the hand of divine providence. These we need for our life here below, and should appropriate and turn them to a better use. These liberal arts were categorized by the philosopher Boethius, 481 to 525, into the famous quadrivarium, music, arithmetic, geometry and astronomy, and trivium, grammar, rhetoric, logic. Meanwhile, the Middle Ages saw technological revolution in agriculture, the rise of commerce, and the institution of new forms of art, ranging from polyphonic music to Gothic architecture. It also saw new developments in the art of war, with technological developments that would allow the West to defeat its enemies in the course of coming centuries. While many historians tout the power of Islamic civilization during this time period, and Islamic civilization did thrive on the Arabian Peninsula particularly, when Islamic civilization came up against Western civilization at the Battle of Tours, Islamic forces were soundly defeated. By the 8th century, Christian leaders were crusading against enslavement, except notably for the enslavement of Muslim war captives. Monasteries were engaging in proto-capitalism as well. Furthermore, the Catholic Church was responsible for learning and teaching. Virtually all literacy sprang from monasteries. Still, the modern world could not have been created under these circumstances alone. Faith provided individual moral purpose. Faith provided collective moral purpose. But while individual capacity was bolstered by the doctrinal belief in free will and the value of work, reason had been made secondary to faith. While collective capacity was bolstered by the presence of a strong social fabric, the all-encompassing power of the Catholic Church and the rule of monarchs meant that individual choice was heavily circumscribed. Even education had been radically reoriented toward the Church. All true knowledge lay in the Bible, and the liberal arts were only useful so far as they bolstered the biblical story. For science and democracy to take hold in the West, reason would have to be elevated once more. That process began with the reintroduction of Greek reason to the West in the 11th century. Christianity, comfortable now in its dominance, could afford more exploratory thinking when it came to secular learning. This bred a new movement called scholasticism, and that movement encouraged Christians to extend the provenance of God's dominance over all of the areas of human knowledge. Scholasticism would open the door for a renewed investigation into the unity between God and his created universe, and between faith and reason. Leading scholastic Hugh of St. Victor, 1096 to 1141, famously stated, "Learn everything. Later, you will see that nothing is superfluous." He followed through on his own injunction by attempting to write a book that covered the gamut of human knowledge, known as a Summa. Scholasticism became the dominant philosophy of the Church. The Church launched a program of support for universities, the University of Paris, also known as the Sorbonne, the University of Bologna, the University of Oxford. As Thomas E. Woods, Jr. writes, the Church provided special protection to university students by offering them what was known as benefit of clergy. The popes intervened on behalf of the university on numerous occasions. But the grandest attempts to reunify Athens and Jerusalem came in the 12th and 13th centuries. During the 12th century, Aristotle's works, long buried, were rediscovered in the West. They had been maintained in the Arabic-speaking world for generations, but they were only retransmitted in Europe over the course of that century, breaking anew and with massive impact in the 13th century. Athens was back. There were several leaders in the newfound attempt to unify Athens and Jerusalem. Maimonides, 1135 to 1204, whom we will discuss later, was the most profound thinker among Jews. Among Christians, the leader in this respect was Thomas Aquinas, 1225 to 1274. Aquinas became father of a philosophy named after him, Thomism. The basic idea was a merger of Aristotelianism and Christianity, a commitment to reason and logic, as well as to revelation. Aquinas stated, "They hold a plainly false opinion, who say that in regard to the truth of religion, it does not matter what a person thinks about creation, so long as he has the correct opinion concerning God. An error concerning the creation ends as false thinking about God. As God was the master of heaven and earth, his creation was evidence of him, and knowledge of that creation would bring us closer to him. But to know God meant first to believe in him. God made man to know God." Aquinas, like Maimonides and Muslim philosophers like Al-Farabi, 872 to 950, concerned himself, therefore, with proofs of God's existence. This was, in and of itself, somewhat revolutionary in the Christian world. Judaism offered no proof of God beyond revelation. God was simply the creator. End of story. And Christianity offered no logical proofs for God's existence. Jesus walked the earth and rose from the dead. End of story. But Aquinas sought to use reason to bolster faith. He offered several proofs of God's existence, the most convincing of which was a form of the cosmological argument promoted by Aristotle. Essentially, Aquinas argued that all things in life are a combination of actual and potential. That a candle, for example, is a candle right now and has the potential to become a pool of wax when operated on by fire. The reason the candle is currently in its state is because of something acting upon it. That something, in turn, is dependent on something else. But, Aquinas argues, that chain cannot continue forever. In the end, there must be a final cause, an unmoved mover standing behind things as they are. That unmoved mover will not be a combination of actual and potential at all. It will be pure actuality, since if it had potential, that potential could only be actualized by another force, which would continue the regress. This final unmoved mover, says Aquinas, is what we call God. And that unmoved mover must exist immaterially, exist outside of time and space, and be perfect. Otherwise, the unmoved mover would not be pure actuality. Aquinas went further still. if reason supports the notion of an intelligent God who crafts nature and stands behind its ever-present glory, Aquinas posited, then human beings can examine the natural world as a pathway to understanding him. God made nature. To discover nature is to investigate the works of God. In fact, God wanted man to do this. God wanted man to seek him everywhere. And God had granted human beings the power of free will and reason to do so. As Aquinas celebrates, man acts from judgment, because by his apprehensive power, he judges that something should be avoided or sought. For as much as man is rational, it is necessary that man have a free will. In Aquinas' thought, Jerusalem and Athens are reunified. God orders us to use our reason, and reason impels us to discover the natural law, laws designed by God. Aquinas is completely comfortable with the notion of scientific discovery and progress. He openly states that if the astronomers of his day were proved to be wrong, that would not refute any of his metaphysics, since perhaps the phenomena of the stars are explicable on some other plan not yet discovered by man. If reason suffices to bring us all this way, according to Aquinas, then why is revelation even necessary? Aquinas here borrows from Augustine. Were we perfect, reasoning beings, revelation might be unnecessary. But we are not. Revelation thus bridges the gap. As theology professor Ernest Fortin suggests, Aquinas believes that between the truths of revelation and the knowledge acquired by the sole use of reason and experience, there is a distinction, but there can be no fundamental disagreement. Aquinas' faith in human reason, and his faith that human reason would not be able to tear down the revelation of God, led to a consonance that would blossom into the scientific revolution. The development of Western science was rooted in the notion that man's task was to celebrate God through knowledge of his creation. Contrary to the propaganda of a postmodern atheist movement, nearly every great scientist up until the age of Darwinism was religious. The scholastic movement produced the earliest roots of the scientific method, all the way up through the discovery by Nicholas Copernicus, 1473 to 1543, of a heliocentric solar system. Perhaps the greatest exponent of the scholastic method was Roger Bacon, 1219 to 1292, a Franciscan friar who devoted himself to understanding the natural world. Like Aquinas, Bacon was a devoted Aristotelian who suggested gathering facts before coming to conclusions. He wrote fulsomely on optics, alchemy, and astronomy. He suggested revising the Julian calendar, which he found obtuse. He even set down the first European formula for gunpowder. The age of scientific progress didn't begin with the Enlightenment. It began in the monasteries of Europe. Flaws in the consonance. This consonance could not last, and it didn't. To see why, we must examine where the legacy of Augustine and Aquinas fell short, and where those shortcomings were brought to fruition in the rise of the Enlightenment. Let us then return to our basic framework for happiness and examine it in light of the dominance of Catholic European thought: individual purpose, individual capacity, communal purpose, and communal capacity. The rise of scholasticism provided a serious answer to the question of purpose. Human beings are placed here by a loving God who seeks from us to do good and avoid evil. This is the same answer provided by Judaism, modified only by simplification of Judaic legalism into Athenian-seeming universal natural laws, discoverable through reason. According to Aquinas, human beings have natural inclinations placed there by God. When we rule those natural inclinations through reason, we discover the good. Augustine would have preached that belief in Jesus provided the sole window to knowing God. Aquinas, while not rejecting that New Testament ordinance, found another window through the use of reason. Aquinas also provided a strong belief in human capacity. Both Augustine and Aquinas believed in free will, but Aquinas' faith in reason stretched beyond Augustine's. That faith in reason would allow Aquinas to make room for exploration of the material world without fear that such exploration would detract from the religious mission to know God. Aristotelian focus on the immanent replaced Platonic speculation about the transcendent. What of communal purpose? Christianity provided a sense of communal purpose in fighting for the good. But Christianity, like all religions, focuses on the spiritual to the exclusion of the physical. And that failure to take into account the drive for betterment in the physical world would be used as a club wielded against Christianity itself before long. When it comes to communal capacity, however, the dominance of the Catholic Church provided a stumbling block. Neither Augustine nor Aquinas would have contemplated a separation between church and state in any real sense. Augustine sought to defend religion against the predations of a secular state, but would have preferred a Christian monarch to a secular one. Aquinas, like Aristotle, believed that the promotion of the common good through the state was worthwhile, even if he demoted that promotion to secondary status behind the promotion of spiritual salvation. While the end of the Middle Ages provided yet another major stone in the foundation of Western civilization then, those foundations were not yet complete. They would not be complete without learning two more critical lessons, the dangers of communal power and the human capacity for material betterment. Chapter 5. Endowed by their creators. If one attitude characterizes modern politics, it's an attitude of complete and utter moral certainty. Those on the political left are certain that those who oppose them are Nazi-esque monsters, hell-bent on domination of individual lives. Those on the political right are certain that the opposite is true. Most important, both sides of the political aisle seem determined at times to use the power available in culture and government to cram down their vision of the world on their opponents, to establish a heavenly kingdom of hegemonic one-party rule. That demand for certainty cuts against the foundations of our very civilization. The history of the West teaches us that while we must share a common vision for our civilization, the means by which we pursue that vision need not be shared. That lesson was learned over the course of centuries at the cost of tremendous quantities of blood and tears. The bricks of the West were mixed from Athens and Jerusalem, yes, but the catalyzing factor was a large dose of humility. By the end of the 13th century, Western civilization was completely dominated by Catholicism. That dominion stretched across Europe, giving new freedom to thinkers like Aquinas, but it also masked serious religious tensions among various orders, as well as even deeper tensions with secular rulers who felt threatened by the arrogation of power to the church. Furthermore, the reign of Catholicism masked serious conflicts within the church itself. All of these conflicts frequently broke out into open conflict. In 1303, for example, Pope Bonifacio VIII found himself arrested by forces in the pay of French King Philip IV, which resulted in the temporary exile of the papacy from Rome itself. From this era of challenges, two strong new ideas emerged. First, human beings are capable of exploring the world and bettering their material condition in it. Second, each human being is free and endowed with natural rights. Skepticism of centralized political power grew from centuries of political and religious conflict. Optimism in the power of science grew from new discoveries made in light of the liberated individual mind. The Renaissance and the Enlightenment completed the foundations of the West that built our world. The power of science. The explosion of science in the West is perhaps the West's best-known, most celebrated legacy. The story of technological development has never changed. Human beings want to live more comfortably in the world. But the story of science changed radically, beginning with Thomas Aquinas and Franciscan friar William of Ockham and their successors. Human beings sought the cosmos through science and used that newfound knowledge to develop technologies that would later be thought to obviate the need for God himself. The secularist myth holds that religion held back science for millennia. The reverse is true. Without Judeo-Christian foundations, science simply would not exist as it does in the West. Contrary to popular opinion, new discoveries weren't invariably seen as heretical or dangerous to the dominion of the church. In fact, the church often supported scientific investigation. Nicolae Oresme, 1320-1382, the discoverer of the Earth's rotation about its axis, was a bishop of Lisieux and a graduate of the University of Paris. Nicholas of Cusa, 1401-1464, Cardinal of Brixen, theorized that the Earth was not stationary, but moved through space. Nicholas Copernicus studied in parochial school and served the Church of Wormia as medical advisor. His publication of De Revolutionibus, his theory that the Earth moved around the sun and not the other way around, in March 1543, included a letter to Pope Paul III. Eventually, the backlash to the inclusion of secular knowledge in the Christian worldview, a backlash led by thinkers like Martin Luther, 1483-1546, and John Calvin, 1509-1564, led to the church's famous persecution of Galileo. Galileo Galilei, 1564 to 1642, famously posited that the earth moves around the sun and was forced to recant by the church for his failure to state that his theory was not fact. Copernicus had been treated with decency by the church of his own time, but in 1616, in response to the new fundamentalist religious wave, Copernican ideas were banned. The ban would last until the early 19th century, and Galileo's official pardon from the Vatican would only be issued at the end of the 20th century. Still, the Thomistic allegiance to both reason and faith could not be quashed. Despite his differences with the church, Galileo never abandoned his own faith that science could be a pathway to God. He wrote, "I say that as to the truth of the knowledge which is given by mathematical proofs, this is the same that divine wisdom recognizes, although our understanding is infinitely surpassed by the divine. Yet when I consider what marvelous things and how many of them men have understood, inquired into, and contrived, I recognize and understand only too clearly that the human mind is a work of God's and one of the most excellent." Galileo was no exception. He was a representative of the rule. Religious men saw a duty to examine the universe and to do so with the best possible methodology. This philosophy permeated the wisdom of the Enlightenment's greatest scientists. Johannes Kepler, 1571 to 1630, the discoverer of the laws of planetary motion, explained, "The chief aim of all investigations of the external world should be to discover the rational order and harmony which has been imposed on it by God and which he revealed to us in the language of mathematics." Kepler routinely described his own physics as part and parcel of Aristotelian metaphysics and explained that the laws of nature are within the grasp of the human mind. God wanted us to recognize them by creating us after his own image so that we could share in his own thoughts. Kepler's philosophy was also that of Isaac Newton, 1642 to 1726. Opposite to God is atheism in profession and idolatry in practice. Atheism is so senseless and odious to mankind that it never had many professors. Scientific progress continued. The progress of science was motivated by a determination to know God's universe, but it became increasingly clear that one significant byproduct of that quest for knowledge was the betterment of man's material status. Like Occam, Francis Bacon, 1561 to 1626, dispensed with the Aristotelian notion of final causes in science. He saw that human beings could all too easily substitute their own conclusory reasons for hard data. To go beyond Aristotle by the light of Aristotle is to think that a borrowed light can increase the original light from which it is taken, Bacon wrote. Bacon's rejection of Aristotelian science also led him to reject Aristotelian teleology more broadly. Man's purpose was not, in Bacon's view, to act in accordance with his nature as a reasoning being. Bacon instead sought purpose in extending more widely the limits of the power and greatness of man. Bacon wanted to turn the pursuit of knowledge toward the benefit and use of men for the glory of the Creator and the relief of man's estate. In tones that remind us of today's modern social scientists, Bacon also suggested the use of science to determine the best mode of governance and ethics. Unlike modern social scientists, however, Bacon took his cue for governance and ethics from the Judeo-Christian tradition. While Bacon upheld the importance of the scientific method and a belief in the pure value of innovation to better the material lives of human beings, Bacon was no atheist. He derided the notion of a godless universe in harsh terms, suggesting that while a little philosophy inclineth man's mind to atheism, but depth in philosophy bringeth men's minds about to religion. Bacon wrote this prayer in Novum Organum: "Let none be alarmed at the objection of the arts and sciences becoming depraved to malevolent or luxurious purposes and the like, for the same can be said of every worldly good: talent, courage, strength, beauty, riches, light itself, and the rest. Only let mankind regain their rights over nature, assigned to them by the gift of God, and obtain that power whose exercise will be governed by right reason and true religion." This last statement is an attempt to read ancient thought and Christianity back into science over his own objections. Bacon's confidence in man's mind to better the world, in accordance, of course, with right reason and true religion, saw further development from René Descartes, 1596 to 1650, who also discarded speculations on behalf of useful knowledge. He saw meaning not in theology but in science, full knowledge of which would surely carry mankind forward toward the perfect moral science. As with Bacon, the good of man lay not in the search for God or the pursuit of a virtuous telos, but in the quest to better the material state of man. Morality would surely follow in the wake of man's technological progress and increased scientific knowledge. Such knowledge, Descartes believed, could not be pursued without radical skepticism of received wisdom. I ought to reject as absolutely false all opinions in regard to which I could suppose the least ground for doubt, in order to ascertain whether after that there remained aught in my belief that was wholly indubitable. This led Descartes to doubt all of his senses, except his knowledge of his own thinking. Thus, Descartes stated, cogito ergo sum. I think, therefore I am. From this basis, he reintroduced a good God who would not create senses that lie to us. Both Bacon and Descartes, while discarding the teleology of the ancients, maintained faith in the Bible and in God. But they also laid the groundwork for the rise of deism, and in time, for the fall of religion itself. By cutting final causes from science, by separating God from the natural world, the modern scientific project would eventually remove religion and purpose from the domain of reason, a project that both Bacon and Descartes would have abhorred. The rise of classical liberalism. The rise of science was coincident with the simultaneous rise of human freedom. The dominance of the Catholic Church over the course of the Middle Ages and Renaissance led some to rebel against the notion of centralized authority altogether. One of the first to do so was Marsilius of Padua, 1275 to 1342, who fought against the notion of papal plenitude of power, the notion that the Church ought to rule in the city of man as well as the city of God. Marsilius saw that the Catholic Church's power could threaten secular authorities, and that those secular authorities could then turn on the Church. Instead of theocracy, Marsilius proposed sovereignty of citizens. His philosophy actually bordered on calls for democracy. He suggested that freedom to worship God itself prohibited theocracy. No wonder Pope Clement VI stated that he had almost never read a worse heretic than that Marsilius. Marsilius's skepticism regarding the Church would be taken to the next level by Niccolo Machiavelli, 1469 to 1527. Like Marsilius, Machiavelli saw oppression in the guise of the Catholic Church. In The Prince, Machiavelli openly mocked the Church. Machiavelli believed that those who proclaimed that the state could be governed in accordance with virtue were merely lying for the sake of convenience. His cynical suggestion, that states be governed in accordance with virtu, a mix of cruelty and kindness generating both fear and love. The goal of such governance? To prevent utopian schemes designed to instill virtue in the citizenry through the power of the sword. In The Prince, Machiavelli proposed that human beings are not driven by reason, thereby tacitly rejecting the ancient notion of Aristotelian virtue, but that they were driven instead by passion. In his Discourses on Livy, Machiavelli suggested that we presuppose that all men are bad and that they will use their malignity of mind every time they have the opportunity. The best way to ensure the freedoms of human beings, then, would be to check passion with passion. The desires of free peoples are rarely harmful to liberty because they arise either from oppression or from the suspicion that they will be oppressed. The people, although ignorant, can grasp the truth, and they readily yield when they are told the truth by a trustworthy man. Machiavelli thus discarded the ancient search for a utopian republic and disdained the notion that a state can exist to make men virtuous. Naturally, as with Marsilius, the Catholic Church banned Machiavelli's Prince in 1559. But the Catholic Church's woes were just beginning. The rise of Lutheranism challenged both the spiritual and temporal power of the Church. Luther, in his ardent attempt to reclaim the Bible from what he deemed the thoroughgoing corruption of the papacy, worked to decimate the hierarchy of believers, leaving merely individuals before God, capable of comprehending God's direct word. A shoemaker, a smith, a farmer. Each has his manual occupation and work, and yet, at the same time, all are eligible to act as priests and bishops. In pursuit of that egalitarian vision, Luther discarded the notion of sanctuary from the secular law. It is intolerable that in canon law, the freedom, person, and goods of the clergy should be given this exemption, as if the layman were not exactly as spiritual and as good Christians as they, or did not equally belong to the Church. Luther's translation of the Bible into German also made practical his notion of individuals communing directly with God. As history professor Joseph LeConte of King's College writes, Luther offered more than a theory of individual empowerment. He delivered a spiritual bill of rights. In the realm of government, Luther was no democrat. He believed that the state's authority did not derive from the authority of the people, but from God himself. We must firmly establish secular law and the sword, that no one may doubt that it is in the world by God's will and ordinance. In consigning reason to secondary status behind faith, Luther demeaned popular sovereignty, though he saw the value of placing restrictions on absolute monarchs. Christians were not to obey anti-Christian commands, for example. Similarly, Calvin believed in an aristocracy governed by checks and balances, but, like Luther, he saw the presence of a particular government as a sign of God's will in action. Nonetheless, it would be Luther and Calvin's religious fragmentation and their devolution of authority down to the individual that would lead to a true transnational movement away from authoritarian government. The horrors of religious conflict from the mid-16th century culminated in the Thirty Years' War, 1618 to 1648, a war that resulted in some 8 million deaths, and forced the choice of religious toleration or mass carnage. It was in making this choice that the notion of human rights was born. The earliest author of that concept was Hugo Grotius, 1583 to 1645. Grotius, unlike Machiavelli, Luther, and Calvin, saw human reason as paramount and society as a way for man to develop his capacity in concert with others. His thought reflects far more the thought of the ancients. Grotius, like Plato and Aristotle, saw natural right as an extension of natural law. You had a right to do that which was in accordance with your telos. As Grotius put it, natural law is the dictate of right reason, which points out that an act, according as it is or is not in conformity with rational nature, has in it a quality of moral baseness or moral necessity, and that in consequence, such an act is either forbidden or enjoined by the author of nature, God. Such right reason could be discovered by looking to the law of nations, including the Noahide laws of the Bible. Grotius extended the concept of human rights further than that. He stated that human beings also had rights to do things, the right to act in pursuit of justice by capturing criminals, for example. Combining the notion of a right to act with the idea that sovereigns were subject to the dictates of natural law, it was a relatively short step to Thomas Hobbes, 1588 to 1679. The rise of the individual. Hobbes is often considered the first rationalist political philosopher. He attempted to map out human behavior with the regularity of mathematics. In doing so, he rejected the philosophy of Aristotle as insufficiently realistic, and, following Machiavelli, suggested instead that human passions were the chief motivation for human conduct. And the chief passion, Hobbes believed, was the passion for saving your own skin. Forget the polis, forget the community. No longer was the goal of human life to fulfill the ends of reason. It was to prevent your own death, as shown by the so-called state of nature, in which men harmed one another so far as their self-interest dictated they should do so. I put for a general inclination of all mankind a perpetual and restless desire of power after power that ceaseth only in death, Hobbes stated. Men's first right, then, was the right to self-preservation. Hierarchies disappear in this regime of natural rights. Large, small, smart, stupid, we are all equal in our right to survive. But in a state of nature, with no one to guarantee our safety, how do we survive? We don't rely on the cultivation of virtue. Instead, we grant power to the state. We require a leviathan, a sovereign heading a powerful state to free human beings from the war of all against all. And that sovereign ought to be seen as representing the collective will of the people. His power is absolute and unchallengeable, granted by social contract from individuals in the state of nature. Hobbes, however, had opened a door that he could not close again. If human beings had individual rights, did those rights end merely with survival? Or, in a state of nature, did human beings enjoy inalienable rights beyond merely breathing and eating and not being murdered? The philosopher who asked that question was John Locke, 1632 to 1704. Following in Hobbes's footsteps, Locke believed that sovereignty resided in the individual. Locke, a deeply religious Christian, believed in both natural law discoverable by reason and Hobbesian natural right inherent in human existence. Natural law, like the ancients supposed, could be discovered in nature. A law dictating through right reason both correct behavior and the purpose for life. Locke based his beliefs in human reason, sovereignty, and equality not merely in ancient philosophy, but in the book of Genesis, in God's suggestion that man is made in his image. Natural rights, according to Locke, were those rights that sprang from exercise of natural law. A right to property, since we had a corresponding duty not to steal. A right to life, since we had a duty not to kill. A right to liberty, since we had a duty not to oppress. Those rights carried with them duties as well. The right to property carried with it the duty to cultivate that property, for example, since God had granted the earth to all people in common, but that our self-ownership to the exclusion of others allowed us to mix our labor with the land, thereby transforming it. Locke radically disagreed with Hobbes about the state of nature. For Hobbes, the state of nature made life nasty, brutish, and short. For Locke, the state of nature was a place of men living according to reason, without a common superior on earth to judge between them. Notice that Locke, a believer in individual natural rights, did not discount community as Hobbes did. The state of nature was not supposed to describe a sort of Eden on earth, but man's status in a pre-political society, in a family, or a community of voluntary association. Over time, such communities would grow, and sovereignty would have to be surrendered to a broader government to guarantee the exercise of fundamental rights. According to Locke, then, the formation of a government requires the exercise of consent, or, alternatively, the behavior of the government in accordance with natural law, for example, a government's willingness to protect natural rights. The goal of law is to preserve freedom, not to trade freedom away for security, as Hobbes would have suggested. The end of law is not to abolish or restrain, but to preserve and enlarge freedom. For in all the states of created beings capable of laws, where there is no law, there is no freedom. Locke suggested a republic of checks and balances as the key to creating such a government. Government, he stated, required two separate powers, the legislative and the executive. Montesquieu, 1689 to 1755, would later set down the more well-known balance of powers enshrined in the American Constitution, legislative, executive, and judicial. Most important for American history, Locke openly recognized a right to rebel against a government that violated the rights of its citizens. Any government doing so would allow citizens to revert to a state of nature in which the citizens could set up a new government. Whenever the legislators endeavor to take away and destroy the property of the people or to reduce them to slavery under arbitrary power, they put themselves into a state of war with the people, who are thereupon absolved from any further obedience and are left to the common refuge which God hath provided for all men against force and violence. Power devolves to the people, who have a right to resume their original liberty. Locke's philosophy would not merely influence the founding fathers of the United States, as we will see. It would shape the foundations of free market enterprise. The vision of Adam Smith, 1723 to 1790, of natural liberty almost precisely mirrors Locke's vision of natural right. The obvious and simple system of natural liberty establishes itself of its own accord. Every man, as long as he does not violate the laws of justice, is left perfectly free to pursue his own interest his own way, and to bring both his industry and capital into competition with those of any other man or order of men. Smith posited that the government had but three fundamental duties: preservation of life, preservation of liberty through administration of justice, and funding for public goods. His viewpoint would be deeply influential in the formation of the greatest economy in the history of mankind. The American Triumph. This long philosophical journey would come to fruition in the first country in history to be crafted based on philosophy, the United States of America. The founding fathers were devotees of Cicero and Locke, of the Bible and Aristotle. They'd done their reading, and they based their new national philosophy on the lessons garnered from that reading. Natural law, rooted in reason and enshrined by religion. Individual natural rights, balanced by corresponding duties. A limited government of checks and balances designed to protect those rights in accordance with natural law. And inculcation of virtue, to be pursued by individuals and communities, again, in accordance with the dictates of natural law. The founders weren't heedless narcissists, unconcerned with the dangers of radical individualism. They feared a society of religionless individuals. Nor were they tyrannical collectivists. They feared mob rule and the heavy hand of government, cramming subjective definitions of virtue down the throats of individuals. All of this is clearly visible in the Declaration of Independence. Thomas Jefferson attempted to enshrine the brilliance of his philosophical forebears in our founding document. In 1825, he explained, "It was intended to be an expression of the American mind. All its authority rests then on the harmonizing sentiments of the day, whether expressed in conversation, in letters, printed essays, or in the elementary books of public right, as Aristotle, Cicero, Locke, Sidney, etc." John Adams, the chief congressional sponsor of the Declaration, mirrored Jefferson's language exactly. The principles of Aristotle and Plato, of Livy and Cicero, and Sidney, Harrington, and Locke, the principles of nature and eternal reason, the principles on which the whole government over us now stands. The Declaration begins with a ringing statement of authority, that of the laws of nature and of nature's God. This isn't the passivity of Hobbes or Augustine or Luther with regard to the value of the current regime. This is the unification of ancient natural law with the force of biblical drive. It is an active statement that men can take power into their own hands so long as that power is utilized in pursuit of the natural law and in accordance with the human right to liberty. Jefferson quickly makes that clear. "We hold these truths to be self-evident," he writes. But clearly such truths are not self-evident. They have not been self-evident for most of human history. Jefferson here references the right reason of the ancients. Those who think properly, who look to the meanings behind nature, can discover fundamental truths that should undergird human life and human action. What precisely are those truths? First, that all men are created equal. Obviously, Jefferson did not mean that all human beings are created with equal capacity. He would have disagreed radically with that notion, since he wasn't a fool. Jefferson originally worked from a draft of George Mason's Virginia Declaration of Rights, which was far more specific. All men are born equally free and independent. Jefferson merely compressed these ideas into the pithier, "all men are created equal." The notion of all men having equal freedom and independence sprang originally from the biblical notion of man being made in God's image, admixed with the Greek tradition of individual reason, and passed down, generation after generation, transmuted over time into the understanding that not only are human beings made in God's image with will and reason, but with the liberty to exercise that will and reason in accordance with the pursuit of virtue. Jefferson continues by stating that men are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. In Locke, that phrase had been life, liberty, and property. Why didn't Jefferson simply use the word property rather than pursuit of happiness? He certainly didn't ignore the right to property because he rejected it. Jefferson routinely talked of the right to the fruits of your labors. Jefferson used the right to happiness because, in Jefferson's view, property and its ownership was not a full enough description of our rights. Jefferson, like Locke, believed that the pursuit of happiness encompassed ownership of our own labor, our own minds. Locke himself wrote at length about the pursuit of happiness, and he did not mean the modern misreading of his phrase, which suggests that we all define happiness in our own way. In his essay concerning human understanding, Locke wrote, "The care of ourselves, that we mistake not imaginary for real happiness, is the necessary foundation of our liberty." This is Locke touting virtue, suggesting that we forego our own subjectivism in pursuit of a higher happiness, discernible through right reason. As Harry Jaffa of the Claremont Institute wrote, "It is difficult to imagine a more forthright Aristotelianism in Hooker or Aquinas." And the founders, despite common misperception of their religious practice, were well aware of the necessity for a community of virtue-seeking religious believers in their new republic. The vitality of religion was a precondition for a healthy society. No wonder the founders placed such heavy emphasis on freedom of worship. Rights and duties, according to the founders, were simply two sides of the same coin. While some critics of the founders have claimed that they ignored duties on behalf of rights, thereby setting the course for societal disintegration, that's a misreading of the founding philosophy. As George Washington stated in his first inaugural address, "The foundation of our national policy will be laid in the pure and immutable principles of private morality. There exists in the economy and course of nature an indissoluble union between virtue and happiness." The culmination. The founding ideology was the basis for the greatest experiment in human progress and liberty ever devised by the mind of man. But then again, it was an idea developed through Judeo-Christian principles and Greek rationality, molded and shaped over time by circumstance, purified in the flame of conflict. It was the best that men have done, and the best that men will do, in setting a philosophic framework for human happiness. Let us examine why. Again, through our framework of the requirements of human happiness. The founding philosophy acknowledges the possibility of individual purpose. That purpose isn't to be supplied by a government, or by molding individual citizens to the service of the polis. That purpose is supplied by a Judeo-Christian tradition of meaning and value, and a Greek tradition of reason. The founders thought that reason was paramount and virtue worth pursuing. That virtue took the form of courage, willingness to sacrifice life, fortune, and sacred honor in pursuit of defending the rights necessary to pursue virtue itself. That virtue took the form of temperance. No better founding document has ever been penned than the Constitution of the United States, the product of compromise. That virtue took the form of prudence. The practical wisdom of the Federalist Papers has not yet been surpassed in political thought. And that virtue took the form of justice, the rule of law, not of men, and the creation of a system where each receives his due. The founding philosophy also glorified the power of individual capacity. The founders were fully cognizant that human beings had the capacity for evil as well as good, for passion as well as reason. But they had immense faith in the power of reason to impel human beings toward proper thinking. Jefferson stated in the bill for establishing religious freedom in Virginia in 1779, "The opinions and belief of men depend not on their own will, but follow involuntarily the evidence proposed to their minds, that Almighty God hath created the mind free, and manifested his supreme will that free it shall remain by making it altogether insusceptible of restraint." John Adams identified liberty itself with the power of reason. It implies thought and choice and power. It can elect between objects, indifferent in point of morality, neither morally good nor morally evil. The only thing, according to Adams, that would turn reason toward good was a societal inculcation of good and a general pursuit of knowledge itself. My humble opinion is that knowledge, upon the whole, promotes virtue and happiness. What of communal purpose? Communal purpose could be sought, according to the founders, in common values, in Judeo-Christian traditions and the heritage of Western rites. Culture and philosophy came together in the young United States to form a united country. And that country's job would be to spread liberty, both domestically and abroad. "We should have such an empire for liberty as she has never surveyed since the creation," Jefferson wrote to Madison in 1809. "And I am persuaded no constitution was ever before so well calculated as ours for extensive empire and self-government." The founders were well aware of the need for collective capacity as well. On the one hand, the founders believed in the individual capacity of Americans to pursue virtue. On the other hand, they distrusted human beings to do so absent social institutions that could encourage such virtuous behavior. And Americans built, cherished, and maintained those social institutions. In Democracy in America, penned in the 1830s, Frenchman Alexis de Tocqueville wondered at the fact that Americans of all ages, all conditions, all minds constantly united. Thus, the most democratic country on earth is found to be, above all, the one where men in our day have most perfected the art of pursuing the object of their common desires in common, and have applied this new science to the most objects. De Tocqueville wisely warned that the replacement of these voluntary associations by government would risk the morality and intelligence of a democratic people. The founders agreed, which is why they sought to limit the power of government so dramatically. In order to protect the rights of individual human beings, and in order to ensure their collective capacity for social action, the founders refused to grant strong central powers to the government. James Madison summed up the sentiment well in Federalist 51. "If men were angels, no government would be necessary. If angels were to govern men, neither external nor internal controls on government would be necessary. In framing a government which is to be administered by men over men, the great difficulty lies in this. You must first enable the government to control the governed, and in the next place, oblige it to control itself." Never were stronger foundations set for human happiness than in the founding philosophy. Of course, that philosophy was not sufficiently universalized even by the founders. It had to be extended in practice to Black Americans and women, for example. The evils of their time did not leave our founders unaffected. The founding was rife with self-contradiction. That great exponent of liberty, Jefferson, a man who called slavery a cruel war against human nature, was a slaveholder and the father of six children by a slave, Sally Hemings. Madison, another slaveholder, said that slavery, based on mere distinction of color, was the most oppressive dominion ever exercised by man over man. But the principles of the founding were indeed universal, just as universal as nature and nature's God. Frederick Douglass, a former slave turned abolitionist, said it best in a speech decrying the thoroughly wrong, thoroughly evil Dred Scott decision, which suggested that black people were not men under the Constitution. The Constitution, as well as the Declaration of Independence and the sentiments of the founders of the Republic, give us a platform broad enough and strong enough to support the most comprehensive plans for the freedom and elevation of all the people of this country, without regard to color, class, or clime. The philosophy of the founders, made material in the creation of the United States and in the continuing quest to fulfill their ideals, has been the greatest blessing for mankind in human history. The United States has freed billions of people. It has enriched billions of people. It has opened minds and hearts. But that founding philosophy, the crown jewel of the West, has not prevailed. It has, instead, been gradually decaying. With that decay, the foundations for human happiness have been eroding. We, in our day, may be watching them collapse completely. How could such a collapse occur? Gradually, slowly, and then all at once. Chapter 6. Killing Purpose, Killing Capacity. Seemingly every year in the United States, a great debate breaks out regarding the separation of church and state. The headlines change, but the underlying conflict is not. It may be a court case about removing a Ten Commandments monument from a public space, or about prayer in the public schools, or about forcing a religious baker to create a custom cake for a same-sex wedding. The root conflict is always the same. Was America built on secular grounds, or religious grounds, or both? More important, will America be made better by curbing religion in the name of secularism, or vice versa? Now, I have argued that the founding philosophy was based on both secular reason and religious morality, that modernity was built on these twin poles, cultivated and perfected through the fires of religious warfare and secular argument. We built a civilization that was practical and purposeful, religious and rational, virtuous and ambitious. Individual capacity and communal capacity had been brought into harmony. Citizens had committed to Judeo-Christian values and individual rights, working to bolster one another. Individual purpose and communal purpose had been aligned. Individuals were set free to cultivate virtue, and communities were built to set the framework for that pursuit of happiness. But advocates for the so-called Enlightenment offer a different theory. They suggest that the philosophy of the modern West, the philosophy of individual rights particularly, sprang from rejection of religion and embrace of reason. The proponents of the self-proclaimed Age of Reason flatter themselves that we live today in accordance with the thought of great Enlightenment thinkers, bold new minds who sprang forth from the ground, wholly formed, ready to do battle with and triumph over the ancients. In fact, the very term Enlightenment suggests a pre-Enlightenment era in which religion inhibited human development rather than fostering it, and by extension, suggests that belief in Judeo-Christian values and God himself was at best an obstruction to modern Western civilization. Furthermore, the most ardent believers in the Enlightenment deride the Greek search for telos as misguided, resting as it does on the assumption of a reality lying behind material reality. They believe that Enlightenment thought could only progress by jettisoning teleology itself and substituting materialism. They argue that the Enlightenment only became the Enlightenment by killing God and discarding the idea of an objectively discoverable purpose. The Enlightenment, they say, shed the vestigial organs of religion and Greek teleology and took civilization to new, uncharted heights. Unfortunately, these claims are manifestly false. As we've seen, history is necessary. If it weren't, Enlightenment could have sprung up anywhere, at any time. Perhaps it should have arisen earlier in societies without the barriers of Greek telos and Judeo-Christian religion. It didn't. It didn't because the philosophy of individual rights, springing from the biblical beliefs that individual human beings are created in God's image and that individual virtue matters, were key to the Enlightenment. So was the search for knowledge, a search rooted in the belief that God had a master plan for the universe, that human beings were blessed with the free will and the reason to investigate that plan, and that we had a moral duty to seek God and to better